Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. So in June of 2005, my governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, announced California's joining the Western States Climate Coalition to take action against global warming. And in his speech, he declared to the world, "I say the debate is over. We know the science, we see the threat, and we know the time for action is now." Well, that was 3 years ago. And the good news of my talk, and it goes downhill from here, but the good news of my talk is that public opinion polls do seem to show that the American people have finally gotten the message about the reality of anthropogenic global climate change. So, for example, last summer in 2007, the Yale Project on Climate Change surveyed American public opinion and found that fully 72% of Americans are now completely or mostly convinced that global warming is happening. In fact, it even goes further. Americans, by and large, do understand that global warming is a very grave problem. 62% believe that life on Earth will continue without major disruptions only if society takes immediate and drastic action to reduce global warming. That's a pretty strong statement, and it's actually, I think, pretty remarkable that 62% of Americans agree with that really, really strong statement. And in fact, in the last couple of years, even many famous former contrarians have come around, and I have a long list of them, which I sometimes have fun playing with. But my favorite one is Frank Luntz, who some of you may be familiar with as the Republican strategist who last year said, it's now 2006. So this is good. He at least knows what year it is. It's now 2006. I think most people would conclude that there is global warming taking place and that the behavior of humans are affecting the climate. Well, the bad news is that Republicans still can't seem to get their grammar right. Okay, but at least we have the basic facts here. Now, Luntz is really important because Luntz became infamous for a memo that he wrote to Republican candidates in 2003 in preparation for the 2004 midterm elections. And in this memo, he gave advice to Republican candidates about how to deal with the perceived weakness and vulnerability of the Republican Party on environmental issues, because polls consistently show that the American people do care about environmental issues, do want the government to protect the environment, and Republicans are perceived to not have a very good record on that. In fact, John McCain has to go back to Teddy Roosevelt to find a Republican president who had a good record on that. Actually, it's not true. He didn't have to go back that far, but he didn't know it, and I'm not going to tell him. But sorry, I'm being very partisan tonight, but with the election coming up, I'm just having trouble controlling myself. But here's what Luntz told. Here's what he instructed Republican candidates to do. He told them to use the phrase climate change rather than global warming. And I get asked about this a lot. What's the difference between global warming and climate change? And the answer is political strategies and tactics. Because he wrote, these are his words, quote, "climate change is a lot less frightening than global warming." So the advice was to change the language, to change the framing, to use language that seemed less alarming than global warming. Moreover, and this is where it gets really interesting, he argued that the candidates should emphasize scientific uncertainty in order to win the global warming debate and to insist that there was no scientific consensus. And again, these are his words, and all of the italics and underline and emphasis here is all his. I've added nothing here. He wrote, quote, "the scientific debate remains open. Voters believe that there is no consensus about global warming within the scientific community. Should the public come to believe that the scientific issues are settled, their views about global warming will change accordingly. Therefore, you need to continue to make the lack of scientific certainty a primary issue in the debate." So using science, scientific uncertainty, as a political strategy and tactic. But the problem with this, of course, was that the science was settled. Luntz's claims were false. In 2001, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the leading international organization that deals with the science of global warming, had written unequivocally, quote, "human activities are modifying the concentration of atmospheric constituents that absorb or scatter radiant energy." In other words, we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere in ways that affect the energy balance of the planet. Most of the observed warming over the last 50 years is likely to have been due to the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations. So that was in 2001, fully 2 years before Luntz wrote his strategy memo. Moreover, in fact, the scientific community had actually been in agreement on this issue since 1995, since the second assessment report of the IPCC, which was issued just around the same time as the Kyoto Protocol. And as early as 1995, The consensus of the scientific community was articulated in this sentence, which has been widely quoted since then, quote, the balance of evidence suggests a discernible human impact on global climate. So already in 1995, we knew that human activities were starting to change the climate, and the question was really how much, how fast, how bad would it get? Now, so if we go back to the good news, we see that most Americans do accept the evidence of anthropogenic warming. Here's a diagram produced by the Goddard Space Center, which shows mean surface temperature anomalies, and we see, you know, this very dramatic anomaly, particularly in the northern polar regions. And I can talk more about that later if people are interested in this. But the bad news of my talk, and we're going to go downhill from here, is that many American people still do not accept the scientific evidence. Although 72% of Americans believe that global warming is real and caused by human activities, 40% think that scientists are still arguing the point. So this is really a remarkable result, right? Scientists have been in agreement since 1995, and yet in 2007, fully 40% of Americans think that there's a lot of disagreement in the scientific community. Moreover, 29% still remain unconvinced that warming is happening at all. So 72% think there is warming, but nearly a third are still not convinced that there is even is warming, much less what it's caused by. And 41%, so nearly half of us, think that warming can be explained mostly or entirely by natural variability. That is to say that it's not caused by human activities. And these Americans include John McCain's running mate. And I've told a few of my friends this. You know, I keep hoping, I mean, success for me would be that I would be able to stop giving this talk, right? And a few months ago, after the Gallup poll came out last summer, I thought, well, maybe, you know, maybe I can quit and go back to doing, you know, other kinds of history. And I have a co-author on this project, my colleague Eric Conway at the Jet Propulsion Lab, who I'd like to acknowledge. And Eric called me up and he said, well, you know, maybe we can go back to doing other things. And then this summer he called me again and he goes, no, we can't. He goes, we're still in business for at least a little while longer. Okay, well, so this is very distressing, right? And here's what Sarah Palin had to say last summer about global warming. A piece in the Washington Post last August said, quote, Sarah Palin told voters she wasn't sure that climate change wasn't simply part of a natural warming cycle. Her spokesman clarified, so the Washington Post called them up to make sure they'd gotten this right. She's not totally convinced one way or the other. Science will tell us. She thinks the jury's still out. But of course, the jury's not out. The jury has been back since 1995. Moreover, in an interview with Newsmax, just to make clear that it wasn't just a slip of the tongue, and it was Palin, not Tina Fey, speaking there, when she was asked, what is your take on global warming? She said, quote, I'm not one who would attribute it to being man-made. But while Palin says that science will tell us, the fact is science has told us, and it has told us that global warming is largely man-made, but mostly caused by greenhouse gases and deforestation. In the fourth assessment report, which came out last year, scientists went even further in trying to use clear language, using the word unequivocal. And as a historian of science, I can tell you, the word unequivocal almost never even appears in the history of science. I mean, this to me is historic that scientists would feel so strongly about this as to use a word of that character in a scientific report. They said it's unequivocal and it cannot be attributed to natural variability. I get asked about the natural variability question a lot. A lot of people ask about solar radiation, global dimming, all this kind of stuff. The IPCC report explicitly discusses this question and says in the following quote, the observed widespread warming of the atmosphere and ocean, together with ice mass loss, support the conclusion that it is extremely unlikely that global climate change of the past 50 years can be explained without external forcing. And by external there, they mean non-natural, that is to say human. So why then do people like Sarah Palin continue to claim otherwise? So what I want to do tonight is to give you a super brief history of climate science, just to give you a sense of the depth and the breadth of the scientific research that has gone into the IPCC conclusions, and then to shift gears and talk a little bit about the political history of the American denial of global warming that I hope will begin to give you an understanding of why we are in the situation we are today, despite nearly 50 years of serious scientific investigation. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the IPCC. Many people know, but for those of you who don't, the IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which consists of thousands of climate researchers from around the globe, And it was established in 1988 by the United Nations Environment Program and the World Meteorological Organization, the largest organization of climatologists and meteorologists, the world's major organization of them. But why was the IPCC created in the first place in 1988? Well, the answer is that it was a response to predictions that had been made in the 1970s. That already in the 1970s, scientists were making the prediction, the forecast, that global warming due to greenhouse gas emissions would likely become a problem probably by around the end of the century, that is to say, around now. And these predictions themselves were the culmination of nearly 50 years of scientific study. So even though Americans have only gotten the message recently, the scientific case has actually been building for many, many decades. So let's just briefly talk about the scientific basis for understanding global warming. And it goes back 150 years to the Irish experimentalist John Tyndall, who first established the concept of a greenhouse gas. That is to say that certain gases, most famously carbon dioxide and water, have the distinctive property of allowing visible light to penetrate them, but tending to trap infrared radiation or heat. So sunlight penetrates the Earth's atmosphere very easily, but when it's absorbed by the Earth, it's re-radiated as heat, as infrared radiation, and that infrared radiation tends to get trapped by water and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so he called them greenhouse gases. And by and large, the existence of greenhouse gases is a good thing because our planet would be frigid, it would be like the moon, if we didn't have some greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So a certain amount of greenhouse gas is a good thing, but like many things in life, like chocolate cake, there can be too much of a good thing, and that's the situation we're in now. The person who first recognized that there could be too much of a good thing was Svante Arrhenius, who was a chemist famous for work in equilibrium thermodynamics, for the chemists in the audience, who was the first person to propose that increasing greenhouse gases from burning fossil fuels could, in fact, be change the climate of the Earth. And he did some of the earliest calculations of the effect of doubling carbon dioxide and predicted that it would cause a global mean temperature rise of between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees C. Now, Arrhenius lived in Sweden, so he thought global warming would be a good thing. But that idea was challenged a few years later by Guy Stewart Callender. And this is a book recently completed by Jim Fleming, who is a close colleague of yours up at Colby College, who I encourage you to invite to talk about Callender's work. Guy Callender was the first scientist to say, well, hold on, global warming might not be a good thing. It might be too much of a good thing. And to argue in the 1930s that there was already evidence, even then, that carbon dioxide was increasing mostly from coal burning, and that it might, in fact, already be having an effect on the climate. And he published this in 1938. Well, 38 was a bad year to get attention for science. The world got distracted by a few other things the following year, particularly Europeans. So not much really came of Callender's work at that time, but he wasn't alone. There were other people following the same thing, too. Sometimes I give these talks to scientists, and if there isn't a physicist saying it, then they won't pay attention. So I decided it was important to find a physicist to put into this story. E.O. Hurlburt, who worked at the Naval Research Laboratory in 1931, published a paper in Physical Review where he did calculations for both doubling and tripling of carbon dioxide and came up with 4 degrees for doubling, 7 degrees for tripling of carbon dioxide. So many people were beginning to think about this question. Moreover, and I think this is a really important point to understand from the perspective of history of science and the perspective of asking the question, you know, well, why should we believe this? How do we know it's true? How do we know it's right? How do we know it's not wrong? Well, it's important to understand that the basic physics, the basic physical laws that control heat transfer in the atmosphere were understood already by the 1930s. And the predictions that were made in the 1930s before anybody ever built a computer model were essentially consistent with what we think we know today. But there was a little bit of a wrinkle, and the wrinkle had to do with water vapor. And this is sort of an important detail, so it's worth spending a moment on. Some people didn't think that increasing carbon dioxide would be a big story because water vapor is also a greenhouse gas, and there's much, much more water in the atmosphere than there is carbon dioxide. So it seemed hard to believe that small changes in carbon dioxide could have much of an effect when there was so much more water in the atmosphere than CO2. And moreover, the absorption spectra for water, so the wavelengths under which water absorbs heat, overlap with the wavelengths absorptions for carbon dioxide. So that implied that small changes in carbon dioxide would be swamped by the much bigger effects of water. However, that problem was resolved in the 1950s by this man, the astrophysicist Gilbert Plass. Gilbert Plass pretty much invented the science of upper atmosphere spectroscopy, that is to say, analyzing the wavelength of light and heat in the upper atmosphere. And he was able to do this because of the advent of rocketry and the early satellite work associated with the International Geophysical Year. And when he did this work, he was able to resolve the absorption bands to a much greater degree of specificity than had ever been the case before, and to show that the absorption bands did not, in fact, overlap, that when you got the details right, they were actually different. And so, therefore, carbon dioxide would not be swamped by water. It actually would have a significant effect. So this was an important wrinkle that got resolved 50 years ago. Now, Plass's work was very important. It was very influential. Lots of people knew about his work. And so it got picked up by these two men who worked at the University of California, Hans Zuse and Roger Revelle. In 1957, they published an article in TELUS, an oceanography journal, an article that's now very famous, in which they argued that mankind was performing, quote, a great geophysical experiment, that fossil fuels had stored carbon dioxide over the course of the entire geological history, 500 million years of geological time, and now, over the course of just a few decades, less than a century, humans were taking that carbon dioxide and releasing it and returning it back to the atmosphere. And they argued that this was a very significant and profound thing and that scientists need to pay attention. And similar arguments were made by other people, most notably Bert Bolin in Europe. Bert Bolin was one of the founders of IPCC and just died a few months ago. Now, Bolin in particular was worried about the long-term consequences of global warming. And sometimes people ask me, well, did Revelle really worry about it, or was he just saying we should just think about it? And from his scientific papers, it's actually a little hard to tell whether or not Revelle was worried, because, of course, most scientists, when they write scientific papers, try to write in an unemotional and dispassionate way. But Revelle gave an interview with Time magazine in 1956, and here's how Time glossed what Revelle had to say then. If the blanket of carbon dioxide produces a temperature rise of only 1 or 2 degrees, a chain of secondary effects may come into play. As the air gets warmer, seawater will get warmer too, and carbon dioxide dissolved in it will return to the atmosphere, possibly raising the temperature enough to melt the ice caps of Antarctica and Greenland, which would flood the Earth's coastal lands. During the International Geophysical Year, teams of scientists will take inventory of the Earth's carbon dioxide. So you can see here that already by 1956-57, Revelle is talking about the potential consequences of global warming. It's not just an academic question. Now, the CO2 inventory, which was began during the International Geophysical Year, became the life's work of this man, Dave Keeling. And the crucial question that Keeling understood was that we know that carbon dioxide can be dissolved in the ocean. And if the carbon dioxide produced by burning fuels, fossil fuels, is mostly absorbed by the ocean, then it wouldn't have much of a warming effect on the Earth. But if it's not absorbed by the ocean, if it goes into the atmosphere where it can have this greenhouse effect, then it would have a big effect on climate. So a key scientific question, now that the spectroscopy thing had been resolved, was how much of the carbon dioxide actually stays in the atmosphere and how much of it is absorbed in the ocean. So Keeling began to measure atmospheric CO2, and this is the famous Keeling curve that many of you have seen. And by 1965, within just 7 years, he had been able to demonstrate that about half of all the carbon dioxide produced by burning fossil fuels goes directly into the atmosphere and essentially stays there for the foreseeable future. So in just a few years, Keeling was able to show a detectable rise, a measurable rise in the carbon dioxide content. And this work caught the attention of a number of important people in science policy circles. So in 1964, a number of reports were written, including one led by the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Weather Modification, which was led by a man named Gordon MacDonald, a geophysicist who served on the President's Science Advisory Committee under both President Johnson and Nixon, and was one of the original members of President Richard Nixon's Council on Environmental Quality. So these were bipartisan committees of very distinguished scientists who had served both Republican and Democratic presidents. And in this report, which they called Scientific Problems of Weather Modification, they warned of what they called inadvertent weather modification. So this was a study of the question of whether you could change the climate deliberately. But they warned of inadvertent weather modification that would be caused by carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels. So this was in 1964. The following year, the President's Science Advisory Committee, Board on Environmental Pollution, wrote a second report headed by a committee that was led by Revellyn Keeling. And in that report, they made the following prediction. By the year 2000, there will be about 25% more carbon dioxide in our atmosphere than at present, and this will modify the heat balance of the atmosphere to such an extent that major market changes in climate could occur. So again, here it is, 1965, scientists are predicting what in fact has now come true. In fact, by the year 2000, this was actually a conservative estimate, by the year 2000, we actually had about a 30% increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now, in 1965, it turns out that at least one American politician was listening, and that politician was Lyndon B. Johnson. In a special message to Congress in 1965, Johnson declared, quote, "This generation has altered the composition of the atmosphere on a global scale through a steady increase in carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels." 1965. Sometimes I give this slide without the label in class, and I say to my students, who do you think say this? And they all say Al Gore, you know. Well, close, but not quite. Yeah. So there it is, 1965. But, okay, 1965, Lyndon Johnson had a few other things on his mind. And, of course, compared with the other issues of the day, greenhouse gases seem pretty minor and far off in the future. The year 2000, right? We can remember when we were kids thinking about the year 2000. I can remember calculating how old I would be in the year 2001. You know, so it seemed like a long way away. But, hey, guess what? Here it is, 2008. It wasn't as far away as they thought. Now, things began to change in the 1970s. Because in the 1970s, scientists began to think, well, maybe it wasn't so far away. Maybe these changes would begin to happen sooner than people had previously thought. And much of this had to do with the development of numerical simulation models, particularly the invention of general circulation models by a group of scientists, including Suki Manabe and many others that I don't need to talk about today. And they began to make more sophisticated calculations based on the same basic physics, but trying to bring in aspects of atmospheric circulation, thinking about the impact of the ocean. And again, though, the basic result was not that different from what Callender and Arrhenius and Plass and others had been saying for a long time, that if you doubled carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you would see an increase in the global mean temperature of around 2 or 3 degrees. So this is in the 1970s, and meanwhile, Dave Keeling is still measuring CO2, and it's starting to creep up and up and up and up and up. So this work gets picked up for a second time by scientists in policy circles. And three major reports published at this time suggested that the problem could be very serious. One was a report that came out of the National Research Council, headed by the head of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency. Another was a report written by the JASEN Committee, which is a group of physicists with high-level security clearances that gave advice to the president on issues of national security. And a third report by the National Academy of Sciences, headed by meteorologist Jewel Charney. So I don't have time to talk in detail about all these reports, but I have a few quotes that just give you a sense of the seriousness with which these scientists were taking this problem, even in the 1970s. So Robert White, a wonderful scientist, he's still alive today, a person that almost everyone I know who knows him thinks is an incredibly wonderful scientist, a wonderful man, and by no means considered an alarmist or hysterical by any stretch of the imagination. But here's what he had to say in 1978. "We now understand that industrial waste, such as carbon dioxide released from the burning of fossil fuels, can have considerable consequences for climate that pose a considerable, can have consequences for climate that pose a considerable threat to future society. The scientific problems are formidable, the technological problems unprecedented, and the potential economic and social impacts ominous." So that was from the director of NOAA. The U.S. National Academy of Sciences had this to say: "If carbon dioxide continues to increase, we find no reason to doubt that climate changes will result and no reason to believe that these changes will be negligible." Well, that's the sort of typical scientific triple, quadruple negative, but you still get the point, right? That these changes would occur. There was no reason to doubt that this would happen. And then this one from the National Academy of Sciences, which I thought was important, that emphasized that the Academy report under Jewel Charney was actually a summary of all of the research that had been done to date, as many National Academy reports actually are. And in the press release that accompanied the Charney report, the Academy actually stressed that there was already a consensus among scientists about the reality of this problem. And so the Academy wrote, "A plethora of studies from diverse sources indicates a consensus that climate changes will result from man's combustion of fossil fuels and changes in land use." And when I came across this in the archive, you know, I really sat up and took notice because, of course, I've done all this work on the scientific consensus, and people have attacked me for saying, oh, no, there isn't a consensus, and Oreskes says there is, but I say there isn't, you know, and this he said, she said sort of nonsense. But here it is. This is the National Academy of Sciences in 1979 telling us that there was already a consensus that climate changes would result. So a consensus about a prediction about what was likely to happen in the future. So in other words, already a consensus that global warming would happen and that it would not be trivial, that it would be serious, that it would be grave, even ominous. And finally, one more from the National Research Council. The close linkage between man's welfare and the climatic regime within which his society has evolved suggests that such climatic changes would have profound impacts on human society. So no question that this was an issue that had social, economic, and political ramifications. And it was these insights then in the 1970s that led to the creation of the IPCC in 1988. So the IPCC didn't create global warming as a problem. The IPCC was a response to the scientific work that had been done in the decades leading up to it. Now, 1988 was also the year, and more or less coincidentally, 1988 was the year that climate modeler Jim Hansen testified in Congress that he was 99% certain that climate change was already detectable. So the predictions from the 70s were mostly about something that people thought would happen in the future. People talked about the year 2000. People talked about the end of the century. But then, much sooner than most people had expected, Hansen comes to the conclusion that the scientific evidence shows that the changes are already starting to happen. And an interesting fact about this, so I went back and looked at the congressional record associated with this testimony and found, again, something that many people seem to have forgotten, that actually there were people in Congress who wanted to take action at that time. And in 1988, a bill was introduced into Congress called the National Energy Policy Act, and its purpose was, quote, to establish a national energy policy to reduce the generation of carbon dioxide and trace gases as quickly as is feasible in order to slow the pace and degree of atmospheric warming. So I wanted to send this to Nancy Pelosi and say, look, you guys could save a lot of trouble. Just pass the National Energy Act of 1988, and we'll be all set, right? I mean, it's kind of remarkable, really, to see the recognition of this problem so long ago. And the New York Times in August of 1988 reported, quote, "The issue of an overheating world has suddenly moved to the forefront of public concern." And it was, of course, this idea that this had moved to the forefront of public concern that led, in 1992, to the Rio Summit, the United Nations Summit on Climate, and to the passage of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which pledged its signatories to take action to stop, to prevent, dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system. And many people have forgotten that our first President Bush, George H.W. Bush, signed the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. The United States is a signatory to that convention. The United States is out of compliance with international law for our failure to fulfill the obligations of the UN Framework Convention. And when he signed the UN Framework Convention, President George H.W. Bush called on world leaders to translate the written document into, quote, concrete action to protect the climate. So again, that was in 1992. And Gus Spieth, who served on the Council of Environmental Quality in the Carter administration, when I interviewed him last year and I asked him about this, he said, yeah, we thought we were on track to make real changes. And many people who were involved at that time thought that the time had come and things were going to happen, that there would be action and we would begin to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. So what happened? Well, part of the answer, I think, is suggested by the poll result that I referred to at the beginning of this talk, that even though the science has now been clear for nearly two decades American people think that scientists are still arguing. So there's this big disconnect between what's happened in the scientific community and the way the American people perceive it. So why? Where has this disconnect come from? And the answer, I think, is because the American people believe that scientists are still arguing because that is what we have been repeatedly told. So if we go back to that Luntz memo, we recall that Luntz advised the Republican candidates to make the lack of scientific certainty a primary issue in 2003, 11 years after the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Now, Luntz gave up that strategy in 2006, but many others did not. So just to pick one example completely at random, we see that some of our political leaders are still using this strategy. So when the IPCC report, the fourth assessment report, came out last year in February 2007, our vice president in an interview with ABC News said the following: I think there's an emerging consensus that we do have global warming. Where there does not appear to be a consensus is the extent to which that's part of a normal cycle versus the extent to which it's caused by man, greenhouse gases, etc. But it's not just a matter of what we've been told in the past couple of years. It's, in fact, a much deeper problem. In fact, it goes back to the late 1980s. It goes back to the very time when the IPCC was first formulated, the very time when Jim Hansen was first saying that global warming was happening. And since the late 1980s, there's been a steady stream of claims challenging climate science. These claims include the claim that there's no proof, that there's no consensus, that if warming is happening, it's just natural variability, that even if it is happening and even if it is man-made, it's not necessarily bad, climate change could be good for you, that we can adapt to any changes that do occur, and that if we were to control greenhouse gas emissions, it would cost jobs, harm the economy, maybe even wreck the economy. Well, we seem to have managed to wreck the economy without controlling greenhouse gases, but that's a different talk. So where did all these claims come from? Who was responsible for making these claims that the scientific community was divided when, in fact, it wasn't really? And the answer is complex, but as a historian, I always try to burrow down and get to the origins of things. And the original source of these claims, it turns out, can, in fact, be tracked to one place, and it's a place called the George C. Marshall Institute, a think tank in Washington, D.C. So if you go to the website of the Marshall Institute, even today, you can find that they are continuing to publish materials that question the scientific evidence. So when this fourth assessment report came out, I went to the IPCC, Marshall Institute page that day and found on that very week an argument by a Canadian climatologist arguing that the widely propagated fact in scare quotes, that humans are contributing to global warming is, quote, the greatest deception in the history of science. I thought, wow, I'm a historian of science, and I can think of a few bigger deceptions. I mean, that's kind of a staggering claim, especially from someone who's not a historian of science. But in any event, so that was on the webpage of the Marshall Institute the week that the fourth assessment report came out. It also, in June, a couple of months later, you could find a link to an article by Patrick Michaels, a well-known contrarian, quote, "The science of warming is far from settled." So here it is, 2007. They're still telling us that the science is unsettled. So where did the Marshall Institute come from? And how did scientific uncertainty become a political tactic? Well, the founder of the Marshall Institute was a geophysicist named Robert Jastrow, who for many years was the head of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. After he retired, he became an adjunct professor at Dartmouth College. And full disclosure, I knew Bob Jastrow at Dartmouth College. In fact, I replaced him in a course he taught in the summer at Dartmouth during sophomore summer, which I only later found out was known as the biggest gut on campus. But in any event, I showed up thinking I was going to teach the students something, and they were like, wait, we thought we were just going to have a slideshow. But in any event, he was a quite well-known astrophysicist who had worked extensively in the space program. And in 1988, he recruited two other colleagues, also both physicists, to join him on the board of the directors of this new institute. One was Bill Nierenberg, who was the director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, again, also a physicist. And the other was Fred Seitz, a former president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. So these were three extremely distinguished people, very accomplished scientists, and very connected in science policy circles because of their work in the space program, in the weapons programs, and heading up major scientific organizations. All three of them had worked extensively on Cold War scientific programs, particularly those associated with weapons and weapons delivery systems. And through that, they had very strong connections with, you know, what President Eisenhower famously called the military-industrial complex, with the directors of weapons systems, with generals and admirals, even with presidents of the United States. And in 1984, they decided that they would launch a program to support Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. Now, some of you may remember when Reagan proposed SDI, it came under very vigorous attack by academic scientists, particularly Carl Sagan and Hans Bethe, who argued very publicly and very strongly against the program on both scientific and political grounds. They argued that technically it was dubious, that you probably couldn't make it work. You could spend billions of dollars for a system that could easily be swamped by decoy missiles. And if people have questions about that, we can get back to it later. And it was wrong politically because it would be diplomatically destabilizing because it would violate the whole notion of mutual assured destruction, which had been the basis of the Cold War balance of power. And in a historically unprecedented move, something that had never happened in the history of the Cold War before, academic physicists declared a boycott of program funds, that they would not accept money from the Strategic Defense Initiative to support research whose purpose was to create a ballistic missile defense system. By May of 1986, 6,500 academic scientists had signed a pledge not to take funds from the Missile Defense Research Program. Well, the Marshall Institute scientists decided to counter this. And they decided that they would defend SDI by showing that not all physicists were against it. That is to say that there wasn't a consensus, even though it might at first glance seem like there was. And that they would counter the attention that people like Carl Sagan were getting in the mass media. And they would do this by addressing the mass media through op-ed pieces, editorial pieces, and that they would target conservative media venues that they thought would be receptive, like Commentary, the National Review, and the Wall Street Journal. And the idea then was to show the American people that scientists were not unified in their opposition to SDI, but that they were arguing. Now, it's important to point out that the Marshall Institute was not a scientific research institute. They never did original scientific research. They never attempted to raise funds to do scientific research. They never produced or edited peer-reviewed scientific journals, because the goal was not to produce science. The goal was to challenge it, or at least to challenge their fellow scientists. The plan, though, was never to debate their fellow scientists in the halls of science, but rather to carry out the debate in the mass media, because that's how they could convince the American people that there was significant dispute about SDI. And if the media did not give them equal time for their views, they would threaten to sue under the fairness doctrine. And we talked about this in one of the classes I was in this morning about, you know, how American sense of fair play leads us to feel that it's appropriate to hear both sides of the issue. And this was actually enshrined in the fairness doctrine that was instituted when radio licenses were first given out, under the theory that if you had a radio license, that was a public trust and you had an obligation not to use it to promote a partisan view of one particular side of an issue, but to give equal time to opposing viewpoints. So that was back in the 1920s and 30s. But using this same concept, Jastrow and his colleagues began to pressure media outlets to give them equal time for their views, even though there were only three of them and there were 6,500 of the others. Well, maybe there were a couple other guys too, but essentially that was what they were working for. So as one example of this, in 1986, the public broadcasting system planned to air a show on SDI that Jastrow considered to be one-sided. And so he wrote a letter on Marshall Institute letterhead in which he threatened the public television stations with lawsuits under the fairness doctrine if this program were aired. He wrote, quote, "The program presents only one side of a matter of great national import. And stations that aired the program, quote, could incur obligations under the fairness doctrine to provide airtime for presentation of contrasting viewpoints." And when he reported on the results of this campaign to his colleagues, he boasted, quote, "Very few public TV stations aired the program." So you can see how they managed to have a kind of chilling effect on the debate by threatening lawsuits if their positions were not given equal time. When they found that the tactic worked, they began to cultivate it and develop it more. And so he wrote, quote, "We intend to continue monitoring the use of public TV for presentation of one-sided programs on technical issues affecting national security." So what you can see here then is that they're pressuring the media for equal time, even though their positions were nowhere near equally held by members of the relevant scientific community. But of course, the press didn't know that. The press didn't really know what the balance of opinion was within the physics community. All they knew was that they could get in trouble, that they could in fact be sued if these guys claimed that they had not been given equal time. Now, most of the early work of the Marshall Institute was related to the Cold War and related to issues that these physicists had a fair degree of expertise about, issues that they were familiar with through their long history of association with Cold War national defense programs. And these included things like nuclear winter, seismic verification, and the future of the space program. But in 1989, the Cold War ended. So you might have thought that they would have been happy that we won the Cold War and that physicists had, in fact, contributed to that success and that they could now happily retire and play golf. But that's not what they did. Instead, they turned to the issue of global warming. And they began to develop position papers and reports in a very parallel way to what they had done to SDI. They began to argue that not all scientists agreed with the emerging consensus and to develop a position that was contrary to the mainstream scientific views, except in this time, it was an area where they really weren't experts at all. So when it came to SDI, I think we could fairly say that these guys, you know, they really were experts about things, about weapon systems, and their opinion was certainly worth hearing on some level. Whether or not it deserved equal time, one could argue about. But now they began to write about global warming, even though none of them were climate scientists and not one of them had ever actually done any research on climate. So in 1990, they issued a pamphlet called Global Warming, What Does the Science Tell Us?, in which they argued that there was little or no evidence that warming was occurring or would occur anytime soon. And even if it did, there was no greenhouse problem because technology would enable us to adapt so long as the government did not interfere with the free market. In 1992, they published a second book, Scientific Perspectives on the Greenhouse Problem. And again, 1992 is not a coincidence. This is really in response to the UN Framework Convention. And at this point, again, the Marshall Institute directly challenged the scientific evidence to deny that the climate records revealed any warming at all, and that, again, even if warming did occur, we didn't have to worry about it. We could just adapt. And therefore, no need for international treaties, regulation, no need for the Framework Convention on Climate Change. Now, by the early 1990s, as President George H.W. Bush did sign the UN Framework Convention, it looked like they were going to lose this debate. But instead of accepting the growing consensus, they sharpened and amplified their attacks. And as the science became firmer, they didn't just attack the science, they also began to attack the scientists. And there are many examples of this, and I only have time to talk about one tonight. One of the most egregious was an attack they launched after the IPCC's second assessment report was issued in 1995. So just to remind you, in 1995, the IPCC concluded that Jim Hansen was, in fact, correct and that the human effect on climates were, in fact, now discernible. But the key chapter of that report was the chapter on what's known as detection and attribution. That is to say, it's one thing to say that the Earth is warming up. It's another thing to be able to say that we know that it's being caused by human activities. And that's a more complicated and subtle question. And so the IPCC had a chapter that was explicitly about how do we know that it's human activity? How do we know it's not just solar radiation or other causes? The lead author of that chapter was a scientist named Benjamin Santer, who's a geophysicist at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, where he continues to work today. Ben is now a friend of mine. He's an incredibly nice guy, an incredibly mild-mannered guy. I mean, he's kind of your scientist. All he wants to do is to be left alone to do science, but fate wouldn't give him that destiny. Because Seitz, Nirenberg, and now a fourth physicist, a man named S. Fred Singer, launched a highly personal attack on Ben Santer, effectively accusing him of fraud. In an open letter to the IPCC, which they sent copies of to many members of Congress and also to the Wall Street Journal, they accused Santer of making, quote, unauthorized changes to the IPCC reports to downplay the doubts and make the science seem firmer than it really was. In the op-ed they published in the Wall Street Journal, which they called, quote, a major deception on global warming, Fred Seitz claimed that the effect of the alleged changes was, quote, to deceive policymakers and the public. So effectively accusing him of fraud, of deliberately tampering with the report to deceive the American public and policymakers and exaggerate the dangers and the risks. Now, what did Santer say had actually happened? Well, Santer wrote a response to the Wall Street Journal, a response that was corroborated by the chairman of the IPC and all of the other authors of the chapter, of whom there were 40 others, because these are big collaborative scientific projects, in which he explained that he had, in fact, made changes to an early draft of the report. And why had he made these changes? Because they were in response to peer review, that the draft had gone through peer review, and as is normal scientific procedure, changes were made in response to the peer review criticisms. In fact, they were changes that he was required to make by the leaders of the IPCC. All of the changes had been approved by the other members of the other authors of the chapter. It was all done as part of normal standard scientific procedure. And of course, Seitz and Nirenberg and Singer, they knew that. They knew how science worked. They were scientists. They knew what peer review was. But never in the attack did they ever even use the words peer review. Did they ever even acknowledge that it was appropriate to make changes in response to a peer review process? In fact, quite the opposite. Neither Singer nor Seitz, at this point Nirenberg kind of dropped out of the picture, neither of them ever retracted the charges. And in fact, the charges were then repeated by many industry groups and think tanks. If you go on the internet today, if you Google Santer climate change, you can still find these allegations on the internet. They've never been removed. This is one of the bad things about the internet. And moreover, 2 weeks after Santer's letter was published in the Wall Street Journal, the journal gave Fred Singer yet another chance to repeat his accusations, so effectively giving him the last word, in which he claimed that Seitz had, quote, revealed that the IPCC report had been tampered with for political reasons. And so this remains in the archives of the Wall Street Journal as a kind of fact that the IPCC report had been tampered with. And many people I've spoken to, many skeptics, will quote this to me and say, this is proof. We know the IPCC is compromised by politics because Fred Seitz showed that it had been tampered with. The 1995 report was tampered with, right? Even though this was refuted by everyone who'd actually been involved with the process. And as I said, these charges remain on the internet today, and they're frequently repeated. I get email from people who say, well, what about that 1995 report, you know? So that was 1995. 2 years later, and this is how I got to know Ben Santer, because he actually contacted me partly because of something I had written, and he told me this story, that he was reading a newspaper article about a group of scientists who had participated in a program sponsored by the tobacco industry to discredit the science linking smoking to cancer. And the article explained that the strategy of the tobacco industry was, quote, to keep the controversy alive. And Ben said when he read this article, it all sounded eerily familiar. And so I explained to him that it was no coincidence, because it wasn't just that the tactics were the same, but the people were the same too. So if we go back to Frederick Seitz and just revisit who he was. So as I said at the beginning, Fred Seitz was an extremely distinguished scientist. He had been president of the National Academy of Sciences. And for a decade, from 1968 to 78, he was the president of what's arguably the most distinguished scientific research institution in America, the Rockefeller University in New York City. But then he took on one last job, a job for which his earlier credentials as a really impeccable scientist, a really impeccable scientific credentials, were really crucial for him being asked to do this final job. And it was to work for the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. Between 1975 and 1989, RJR Nabisco, the parent company of R.J. Reynolds, spent $45 million on a biomedical research program whose purpose was to support research that focused its attention on causes of degenerative disease other than tobacco. So in other words, a kind of confounding project where you didn't necessarily deny that smoking could cause cancer, but you focused attention, a kind of refutation by distraction. You focused attention on other causes of cancer so as to distract attention from the effects of smoking. So that project began in 1975, and in 1978, Seitz became the director of that program. And there's a tremendous amount of documentary evidence about this in the tobacco legacy documents on the internet that have been revealed through the discovery process because of the tobacco litigation and the tobacco master settlement. And so these are, again, just tidbits out of a much longer and complicated story. But the focus of this project was to identify highly promising young investigators who are underfunded at present. So in other words, find smart young scientists who are having trouble getting their careers going, maybe having trouble competing for NSF funds because it's tough to launch a scientific career, and offer them money to get started. In 1979, in a speech to tobacco executives, Seitz explained how he had come to work for the Reynolds Corporation. Quote, "About a year ago, when my period of president of the Rockefeller University was nearing its end, I was asked if I would be willing to serve as advisor to the board of directors of R.J. Reynolds as it developed its program on the support of biomedical research related to degenerative diseases in man, a program which would enlarge upon the work supported through the Consortium of Tobacco Industries." And this is a sort of subtle detail that could easily escape attention, but this fact here, that it was supported by a consortium of tobacco industries, was in fact the basis for the industry later being charged with conspiracy and racketeering, and for the master settlement under which the tobacco industry acknowledged that they had in fact conspired to suppress evidence and have paid out now hundreds of millions of dollars in settlement fees. Seitz went on and he said, quote, "Since R.J. Reynolds had provided very generous support for biomedical work at the Rockefeller University, I was more than glad to accept." And in one of the classes this morning, we talked a little bit about this. I mean, most of us welcome corporate support for academic research. We could hardly do the work we do in universities in America if we didn't have support from private corporations and foundations. And yet, here you see one of the possible tricky things about that whole issue, right? So the Rockefeller University for years had been given gifts by the R.J. Reynolds Corporation, no strings attached gifts. That Reynolds was just being a good corporate citizen and supporting biomedical research. And then when they came to Seitz to say, would you work for us? He said, well, hey, I was more than happy to accept. Now, maybe he would have been happy anyway, but, you know, it certainly looks like there's a pretty close connection right here. A former Reynolds CEO, Colin Stokes, further explained the goals of the program. He claimed that the charges that tobacco was linked to cancer, hardening of the arteries, and carbon monoxide poisoning were tenuous. And, quote, "Reynolds and other cigarette makers have reacted to these scientifically unproven claims by intensifying our funding of objective research into these matters." And moreover, he defended the program on the grounds that science really knows little about the causes and development of chronic degenerative diseases imputed to cigarettes, including lung cancer, emphysema, and cardiovascular disorders. Many of the studies that link smoking to these diseases were either incomplete or relied on dubious methods or hypotheses and faulty interpretations. The overall goal of the program, the overarching goal, was to create reasonable doubt that could be used in court. And he explained exactly how it worked. And this is one of my favorite tobacco documents. So this is in 1979. "Due to favorable scientific testimony, no plaintiff has ever collected a penny from any tobacco company in lawsuits claiming that smoking causes lung cancer or cardiovascular disease, even though 117 such cases have been brought since 1954. Now, this is an amazing comment because, of course, the good news is that that is no longer true, that after the mid-1980s, plaintiffs did begin to win lawsuits as the truth about this began to come out. But 1954 is a crucial year because 1954 is the year that the tobacco industry created this consortium to challenge the scientific evidence, because it was the year that researchers at the Sloan Kettering Research Institute proved unequivocally that tobacco tar did cause cancer by painting tar on the skin of mice and showing that 100% of the mice who had tar painted on their skin developed tumors. And when this work came out, the tobacco industry was panic-stricken and began down this path of not admitting the truth and saying, okay, well, let's think about what to do about the fact that we have a highly dangerous product, but rather of challenging the scientific evidence. So 54 is really a crucial year, and here we are in 1979, still following that same strategy and tactics. So for more than 30 years, the tobacco industry staved off litigation. Successful. This tactic was successful for more than 30 years. It eventually ran its course, and we all know about it now, because they did, in fact, finally lose in court. But for 30 years, they successfully staved off litigation, continued to sell billions of cigarettes and make billions of dollars in profits. There's all kinds of documentation about how their profits are continuing to go up and up during this whole period. Staved off litigation and also staved off really any kind of strong or effective regulation by emphasizing scientific uncertainty. by saying that the science was unproven, that the hypotheses were faulty, that the data were incomplete. And this, of course, is exactly what Seid, Singer, Nirenberg, and the others then did with respect to global warming. So my argument here is that this is not a coincidence, that there's actually a direct connection between these campaigns in the person of Fred Seid. If we look at Fred Singer, we can tell a similar story. He was also a physicist, also built his career during the Cold War, worked on rocketry and in the National Weather Satellite Program, worked as chief scientist in the Department of Transportation, the Reagan administration, so very well connected in science, administration, and policy work purposes, circles, and in the 1990s began to work with Seitz and Nirenberg challenging climate science. Between 1988 and 2003, Fred Singer published at least 35 articles, letters, and op-ed pieces in popular journals challenging the scientific evidence of anthropogenic warming. Many websites and list servers began to develop in the late 90s and into the early 2000s that cited his work and those of other people associated with the Marshall Institute. And as many of you know, it also, of course, became picked up by talk radio. But it wasn't just global warming. In fact, what we see, and this is the subject of the book that I'm completing right now with Eric Conway, that in fact, these people challenged the scientific evidence on every major environmental issue in the 80s and 90s. So in the 1980s, they challenged the scientific evidence linking sulfur and nitrogen emissions to acid rain. Fred Singer played a major role in that argument. In 1995, Singer testified in Congress that there was no scientific consensus linking CFCs to the ozone hole. And this is one of my favorites. He testified in October 1995 that there was no scientific consensus about the causes of the ozone hole. And 3 weeks later, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to Paul Crutzen, Mario Molina, and Sherry Rowland for work that demonstrated that the cause of the ozone hole was CFCs. So, I mean, it's completely erroneous testimony. And Singer, like Seitz, also defended tobacco. Again, a long story that I'll cut to the quick, but if in 1986, the Surgeon General issued a report on the health consequences of involuntary smoking, in which the Surgeon General's panel declared that involuntary smoking is a known cause of disease, including lung cancer in otherwise healthy non-smokers, especially infants and children. And as a consequence of this work and other work, in 1992, the Environmental Protection Agency declared secondhand smoke to be a Class A carcinogen, meaning something that has been proven by scientific research to cause cancer. When the EPA came out with that conclusion, Fred Singer went on the attack. And he went on the attack with a project that was funded by the Tobacco Institute indirectly through a think tank, the Alexis de Tocqueville Institute. And this is one of the ways that these things work, that industry would fund third parties like think tanks and allegedly nonprofit organizations who would then fund the project. So Fred Singer could claim that he wasn't working for the tobacco industry, but if you trace the money, you find that it goes back to the tobacco industry. And in fact, it's more than that. He was actually working as a paid consultant to Philip Morris during this time, and there's lots of documentation about that. So he wrote a report called EPA and the Science of Environmental Tobacco Smoke. In it, he attacked the Environmental Protection Agency, claiming it had, quote, violated scientific standards to justify a political agenda. Well, what was the so-called violation? It was the use of a linear dose response model with no threshold to evaluate the hazard. That is to say, to assume that the greater the dose, the greater the risk. Now, was this a violation of scientific standards? Well, if you read the EPA guidelines on risk evaluation, which I've done, and which any person, member of the public can do, it's on the EPA website, it's available in most public libraries, you find that EPA guidelines actually require the use of a linear dose response model unless there's evidence to support an alternative interpretation. That is to say, basic scientific principle of Occam's razor, you take the simplest explanation that explains the data unless you have reason to believe otherwise. The simplest explanation in a dose response curve is that the bigger the dose, the greater the response, right? The more of a poison you ingest, the more it's likely to hurt you. And this is standard operating procedure, not just for the EPA, but the National Institutes of Health and in every major organization that deals with risk assessment. But Singer, however, argued that this was a violation of scientific standard, that the EPA had done bad science, faulty science. And in fact, he had presented no evidence to support his claim because there was no evidence for a nonlinear dose response curve. But instead, he simply invoked the Paracelsian motto, the dose makes the poison, suggesting that a very low dose, secondhand smokes, would not do any harm. And I have to say, as a historian of science, I nearly fell off my chair laughing when I saw this, because Paracelsus, of course, died in 1541. So Fred Singer was invoking 500-year-old science to attack the Environmental Protection Agency. Well, the four physicists in this story lost these debates. We know that air pollution does cause acid rain. We know that CFCs do deplete the ozone layer. And we know that secondhand smoke does cause lung disease, lung cancer, and many other diseases. And there's been abundant research on this since 1995 that amply confirms the EPA conclusion, in fact, even showing that secondhand smoke is a major cause of sudden infant death syndrome. So we see that these physicists were on the wrong side, the losing side of every major argument that they got involved with. And if we ask the question, well, how could somebody have that consistent track record? We have to look more closely at the argument. And what we see here is that the argument was always the same. No matter what the issue was, the argument didn't change. It was that the science was uncertain, that the concerns and anxieties were exaggerated, that technology would solve the problem, but if and only if there was no government interference. If the free market were allowed to respond, the free market would develop technological solutions to these problems. And therefore, no need for government regulation, no need for international treaties, no need for the Kyoto Protocol. And this, I believe, is actually the heart of the story, the heart of the story that explains why distinguished scientists would attack their fellow scientific colleagues, which on the face of it seems like a pretty strange thing that they would have done. So when I first started doing this research and I started talking about it before I had gotten really deep into the ideological dimensions, most people assumed that the story would end as a story about money, a story about people being corrupted by money. But the answer is that it isn't about money. That in fact, although some of these guys did get paid to do the research they did, there's very little evidence, and I would say actually really pretty much no evidence, that money was the motivating driving force in the story. Rather, the motivating driving force was political ideology. And it's the ideology of laissez-faire. Because in each one of these cases, the consistent pattern in the story is that in each case, the larger goal was to stave off government regulation. And that, I think, also explains the origins of the story in SDI, which otherwise might seem a bit peculiar. Because if we think about SDI, the goal of SDI was the same as all the Cold War U.S. rocketry and weapons programs that these men had participated in all their lives, to defend the United States against Soviet communism and to win the Cold War. Jastrow, Seitz, Nierenberg, and Singer were all fiercely anti-communist. And they were also fiercely opposed to government regulation or government control of any kind, but especially in the marketplace. They consistently argued that technology would develop to handle problems, and as I said, this is a free market argument, that the problems will naturally resolve themselves if markets are left alone. And of course, if you cast your mind back to the 1960s, you'll remember that in the 1960s, when the scientific evidence about the harms of tobacco first became widely known among the public, the defense of tobacco that the tobacco industry used was a defense against government intervention in the marketplace, that it was cast by Philip Morris and other tobacco corporations in terms of the rights of free grown-ups to make their own choices in their own lives, and a defense of the free market as a kind of foundation of American prosperity. So thus, and you can see evidence of this throughout the writings of these individuals. So for example, when Seitz attacked Ben Santer in the Wall Street Journal, he wrote, quote, IPCC reports are often called the consensus view, but if they lead to carbon taxes and restraints on economic growth, they will surely have a major and almost certainly destructive impact on the economies of the world. So it's not really an argument about the science. It's an argument about economic growth and global economies. And similarly, when Singer defended secondhand smoke, if you ask the question, why would anyone defend secondhand smoke? He argued, quote, if we do not carefully delineate the government's role in regulating dangers, there is essentially no limit to how much the government can ultimately control our lives. So today, smoking, tomorrow, freedom of speech. And when Frank Luntz attacked climate science before his conversion in 2006, he wrote, quote, Once Republicans concede that greenhouse gases must be controlled, it will only be a matter of time before they end up endorsing more economically damaging regulation. So this, it seems to me, is what George Soros has called market fundamentalism, that it's a kind of unshakable faith in markets to solve all problems, even the sort of environmental problems which many economists would recognize now as textbook cases of market failure. But it stems from a kind of intractable hostility to government regulation as a form of creeping communism, the very thing that these men had dedicated their lives to fighting against. And it explains a phrase that they sometimes used, describing environmentalists as watermelons, green on the outside, red on the inside. And this, I think, helps to explain also then why global warming became the fight of all fights, the mother of all environmental issues. Because as we all know, energy consumption is at the root of all economic activity. There isn't anything we can do, even giving a talk like I'm giving today, without using energy. So if we address the need for the government to become involved in energy markets, then we've really acknowledged that the government has to intervene in the marketplace, whether we like it or not. And so the concern that these men had throughout the 1990s was that doing something about global warming would lead the United States to agree to international treaties like the Kyoto Protocol, which would ultimately undermine national sovereignty, and that having won the Cold War, we would in the end lose the peace. Richard Darman, who was director of the Office of Management and Budget, again under the first President Bush, said, and I love this one, "Americans did not fight and win the wars of the 20th century to make the world safe for green vegetables." So Barry Goldwater famously once said that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. But I think that this story proves otherwise. Because these men who I've been talking about tonight may have been perfectly justified in their political beliefs. And moreover, I knew some of them, and they were actually nice guys. I mean, to meet them, to chat with them at a cocktail party, they weren't monsters, they weren't demons, they were interesting, smart people. But they didn't make a political argument on political grounds. Rather, they camouflaged a political debate as a scientific one. And in the process of doing that, they grossly misrepresented the state of the science, they confused the American people, and arguably they delayed political action on one of the major global issues of our time. Now, in the 1980s, when scientists were first getting serious about global warming, many people argued that we could afford to wait and see. But I think what many people don't understand is that we have waited and we have seen. And what we've seen is that the predictions that were made going back as far as the turn of the century with Svante Arrhenius, the 1930s with Guy Callender, the 1950s with Roger Revelle, what we've seen is that these predictions have largely come true. Global warming is here, and there are almost no communists left. Thank you very much.
I guess I was a little bit more concerned until I saw the end of your argument, which I thought was very profound. But how constructive is this argument if you're spending your whole time like attacking conservative ideology? Doesn't that kind of undermine the greater goal of, you say like a third of all people don't believe in global warming, and those people are most likely to listen to like conservative ideology, I guess. And if you're just attacking like the conservative intellectuals, don't you run the risk of really polarizing people? Like, if people were in this room who did not believe in global warming at all, heard your argument, they probably got kind of offended as it went through. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I take the point, and it's something I've obviously thought about. My goal is not really to convince the 29% of people who are not convinced, because honestly, I mean, 29% of Americans don't believe smoking causes cancer, and I don't believe there's anything you could say that would change their minds. Rather, my goal is for us to understand the situation we're in today. Why are so many people confused? Why are people who are open-minded about the question confused about the issue? There are some people who will never be convinced, and that's unfortunate, but it's probably simply the reality. But there are a lot more people who honestly do believe that the jury is still out scientifically, And so I have had the experience of giving this talk to community groups where there were people like that in the audience who did say to me, wow, this talk really opened my eyes. So that's my greater goal. My greater goal is for us to understand this history and to show that this is really an ideological argument and that it's been an ideological argument from the beginning. And I don't think you can respond to an ideological argument with science. And I don't think you can correct an ideological argument by ignoring the ideology that's involved. So it's not my purpose to demonize these people. And like I said, I knew Bill Nierenberg. He was a nice guy. I mean, it's a little weird for me that a person can be so nice but also do this weird stuff, you know. I mean, so people can be multifaceted and complicated, and I think these guys were multifaceted and complicated. And I still respect their scientific work. It's not to say that these men were not distinguished scientists. They were. But they also became involved in an ideological campaign that was driven not by science but by ideology. And that's the argument which I think is a really important one for us to understand. So I recognize that there would be some people who may be upset by this. There will be some people who will walk away and say, I'm sorry, I still don't believe it, or, you know, she's just a liberal or whatever. But the other thing that's important to point out is I didn't come into this work because I was worried about global warming. I came into this work because I was a historian of science, working on the history of science, working actually on the history of oceanography, and I stumbled across this stuff. And I thought, oh my God, you know, what is going on here? And Bill Nierenberg, who I knew as a distinguished scientist and as a director of the institution that I have an academic appointment at, was involved in these, you know, what are, to my mind, really quite disturbing activities. So I feel this is a story that people need to hear about, that you need to know about, and that people need to understand the truth of what has happened. If some people can't accept it, won't accept it, think that I'm just a tool of, you know, the Obama campaign, that's unfortunate. I can say I'm not. You know, because Al Gore picked up my work, some people think that I work with Al Gore. I don't. He picked up his work completely, my work completely independent of me. I didn't ever send my work to the Gore people. They found it on their own. So I'm a scholar, I'm an academic, I'm a historian. I do work that I think is important historically, and that's the motivation. The motivation is historical understanding. And I hope that by having historical understanding, it gives us a better toolkit to think about how we can respond to these challenges, and that's really what my goal is.
So I work on law, and this is very familiar to me because these debates about the meaning of international law really focus on exactly the same, a few people saying there is no consensus, even though overwhelmingly there is consensus that has, you know, been built over time, but at some point it's there. So it made me want to ask you about the international dimension of this Alexis de Tocqueville ideology, because I think that there is a strong one in terms of hostility to both the UN and to international consensus normatively in general. And I wondered if that's something you're going to put into the book.
Yeah, so the question is about international law, international treaties, and whether I'll put that in the book. I'm not going to put it in the book because this is already a really big story, and I'm trying to keep a handle on it, which is why I talk about the American denial of global warming, because there is a kind of particularly American quality to a lot of this story, and that's, and also as a historian, you know, I'm particularly interested in some of the aspects of American culture which have made this story possible here. In terms of the international dimension, it's obviously extremely important, and you're right, part of the story is a hostility to internationalism among certain sectors of the American people, and you see that when some people who don't like the IPCC reports refer to it as a UN organization. And of course, the IPCC is not a UN organization. It's a scientific organization that was organized by the World Meteorological Organization in conjunction with the United Nations Environment Program, which is itself a scientific program. So there's no question that some people try to discredit the IPCC because of its international or UN affiliations. The main thing I think when I think about the international dimensions is the whole ethical aspect of this problem, which we haven't really had time to talk about tonight, but which I think is extremely important. It's all very well and good to say that you believe in free markets, that you'd prefer a world in which the government doesn't interfere in our lives. And I agree with that. I don't want the government telling me what to do in my life. I don't want the government telling me whether I can use birth control. I don't want the government telling me what I can read in the library. I don't want the government telling me what I can teach my children. So I share many of the values that these people in the story share about understanding the really important dimension of controlling what the government can do in terms of our personal and private lives. And I think that's a really important threat in American history, which I don't mean to discredit or discount in any way. However, when it comes to an issue like global warming, this is not just an issue about America, because what we do here in America affects the whole world. And one of the ethical, important ethical dimensions of global warming is that we in the United States have benefited from burning fossil fuels. We in the United States and in Western Europe have benefited from 150 years of industrialization driven by the power stored in fossil fuels. We've become rich, we've become healthy, we've become wealthy. Unfortunately, we haven't become wise, but you know, we have benefited from burning fossil fuels. But now we face a situation where those activities have consequences, and the consequences will be felt by everyone around the world, not just the people who have benefited. In fact, in some areas like sea level rise, the people who have benefited the least will be the ones who will probably suffer the most. And that's unethical, right? That's simply unfair. So if you care about fairness, if you care about the most basic concept of fairness, that if you've benefited, you should pay, right? That if you won the game, you should pay what it costs to play, or however you liked it, whatever your favorite metaphor is, then we have a real responsibility here. And we have a responsibility not just to do something about our own carbon footprint, but we have a responsibility to provide leadership and to help developing nations that want to share in the prosperity that we have enjoyed to be able to share in that prosperity by helping to develop the technologies that will enable them to do so without destroying the North Polar ice. So that's how I think about the international dimension, that we have a responsibility here, a responsibility that it is really immoral and unethical to shirk.